Hello, I'm Father Benedict Rochelle of the Franciscan Friars of the Renewal from the South Bronx. And this is the second segment of our series on prayer in the New Catechism of the Catholic Church. And as I mentioned previously, the whole last quarter of the Catechism is dedicated to prayer. The question we're really posing in this series is how Christian is my prayer. But today, we're going to look at the prayer of nature. In fact, I was thinking about it myself. This may be the oddest talk you ever heard a Catholic priest give about prayer in your life, because I'm talking about the universal prayer of human beings. All human beings are called to pray by the natural law, to give honor and thanksgiving and adoration to their Creator. They are obliged to do this. And as a matter of fact, the vast majority of human beings who have lived since prehistory have been religious people. In the modern world, we think that people aren't particularly religious. Perhaps they are less religious than they used to be. But the great cultures of the past, almost without any exception, were primarily religious. That every aspect of human life, every moment of every day, was defined and colored by the search for the force, the power, the being, the person who made them. And in Christianity, we refer to this as the natural law. One of the obligations of the natural law is to worship, do honor, and to obey your Creator. And if you have any doubts about this, and I may have some people here a little bit uncomfortable when I say this, because they think about religions outside of the Bible as essentially bad. The Bible generally, not always, looks upon the other religions as paganism. Now, they had their troubles with the pagans, and some of the people they were dealing with were awful. But St. Paul makes it very clear that everyone has a road to God. And he's very critical of some of the people of his time, some of the non-Jews, the Gentiles, a word that means the people of the nations, for not worshiping God. In Romans 1:18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men, who by their wickedness suppress the truth. What truth? For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely, his eternal power and divinity, have been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. And so they are without excuse, for although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but became futile in their thinking, and senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal men or birds or animals or reptiles. Now, St. Paul knew very well that he lived in a world filled with religious people who did not know about the God of Revelation. They never heard of it. When he went to Athens was a very religious pagan city. It was dominated by a huge mountain and acropolis on which stood some magnificent architecturally beautiful buildings, temples to the gods, the Acropolis. You can still see them now. These buildings later on would all be made into Christian churches. Most people don't know that, but the great Temple of Athena in Athens spent many more centuries being a Christian church than ever it spent being a temple to Athena. At the time of Constantine, it was converted into the cathedral of the diocese, Archdiocese of Athens. Now, St. Paul says that what can be known about God from the things that are seen? His almighty power and his divinity. In modern language, we might say his omnipotence and his transcendence, his being of God. And it's extremely interesting to realize that all over the world, people search for God. Sometimes Christians reduce all of these people to what they call the pagan. Pagans is a word that means people who live in the country. Pagani. The countryside is the pays in French. The paysans, the people of the country. And these people became Christians much later than the Christians of big cities. At the end of the Roman Empire, the Christians tended to live in the towns and cities, and the people in the countryside still followed the old Greco-Roman religion as best they could, whatever they knew about it. So they came in later, and so they were called pagans. Actually, many of the religions of the world, the great religions of the world, have a very high sense of the spirituality of God. And here I should preeminently mention Buddhism. It's absolutely absurd for a Christian or a Jew to refer to a Buddhist as a pagan. It simply is insulting. And if you know really something about the Hindu religion, the same can really be said. It's a little harder for Western people to understand that in the Hindu religion, what are called gods are really aspects of the divinity leading up into the mystery of God. But let's leave that there and just say that everyone experiences the obligation to acknowledge the divinity and the almighty power of the force, the being that made them. And the vast majority of people in the world do pray and do think that somebody hears them. Ultimately, if you push it far enough, take into account all of the different expressions of culture, the majority of the people in the world are monotheists. They believe in a one personal God. Not too long ago, a Buddhist scholar contacted me and wanted me to be very clear on the fact that very large numbers of Buddhists are explicitly monotheistic, rather than what sometimes is used as a term I don't really think is too accurate, an atheistic religion, a non-theistic religion. Surely there are Buddhists that do not believe in a personal God, but this scholar, who is himself a born Buddhist, assured me that many Buddhists should be most accurately described as monotheistic. I think it's an illusion that Western people have because of some of the scholars who were anti-religious who wrote in the 20th century and convinced people that many people in the Orient did not believe in a personal God. And I'm going to get around to this. In the Bible, some of these people who are not children of Abraham or Christians, Jews or Christians, do very well. Do you know that there's a whole book of the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible named after a pagan woman, Ruth. Ruth. And when Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, tells Ruth and her sister-in-law to go back to her people, she says, go back to your mother's house and to your own people and your own gods. Surely she wasn't inviting her to do something against the will of God. But I think it's much more sane to interpret that statement as saying your own religion, your own approach to God. It's interesting also that sometimes the Jews are saved by someone who is not a Jew, the Emperor Cyrus, for instance. Great help to the Jews. In the Christian gospel, we have, first of all, The first two groups of people that meet Jesus, one are non-observant Hebrews, the shepherds. You could not observe all the regulations of the Jewish law very well and be a shepherd, so they were kind of outcasts. And the others are the Zoroastrians, the Magi, the sometimes called the kings, which is the wrong expression, the astrologers who came to worship the Christ child. Several times our Lord runs into people who are Gentiles. The centurion of Capernaum was one of those who feared God and had built a synagogue for the Jews. He was right on the edges of the Jewish religion. And there's that little pagan lady, the Syrophoenician woman, who comes and asks for a miracle, to be healed. And Christ says, your faith has saved you. It is a pagan, the only person is a pagan who lifts a finger to save Jesus at the time he is condemned. The apostles run away. The high priest condemns him. The Roman governor condemns him. But a Gentile woman, the wife of Pilate, attempts to save his life. The only one who lifted a finger to help him. And so, we have some things to learn. And I'm going to, I told you this would be an unusual talk, to take a look at what St. Paul means when he criticizes the Gentiles of his time for not worshiping God and for worshiping idols. A couple months ago, I had the marvelous experience, a few months ago, of taking a group of priests on a pilgrimage in the footsteps of St. Paul in Greece and Asia Minor, or Turkey. Now, when you go to Greece, many of the monuments are the monuments of the ancient Greek pagan civilization around which the things of the gospel took place, things of the spread of the gospel. So there's the Areopagus in Athens, below the Acropolis. Here's the Acropolis, here's the Areopagus, the marketplace where St. Paul preached. I doubt if he went up onto the Acropolis because it would have been a place entirely of pagan temples. And here we see the footsteps of St. Paul. Now you can walk up into the Areopagus because, as I said, most of those temples were churches. And it is amazing the skill, the artistic ability which these people put into constructing these temples, which were an attempt to know the unknown God, as St. Paul pointed out. When he went to Athens, he said, look, I'm going to tell you something about God. Sometimes these pagan religions became iniquitous. We see that at Corinth, which was a temple to lust, the Acropolis at Corinth. The goddess of Corinth was Aphrodite. The clergy of this temple went throughout the ancient world hiring slave girls, bringing them back to be ritual prostitutes in the temple. A horrible thing. But there were other places in Greece where this did not go on. Oh, some were awful. The temples of Dionysus, a god of misbehavior and sexual ecstasy and overindulgence. But there were other approaches. I think the most fascinating religious place in the whole ancient world is Delphi. And if you ever get to Greece in the footsteps of St. Paul, take a little excursion up to Delphi. He never went there. Delphi is a sacred city built high in the mountain crags going up to the top of the mountain. And people came to this place in an attempt to hear the voice of God. They didn't, but they were trying. They took it seriously. The ruins of this city are incredible. Right up the side of this steep mountain, the sacred way, many temples, and at the top, the place of the oracle, a huge amphitheater in the place of the oracle. The oracle was a woman, a virgin, who was raised to have this position. And when wealthy people came to hear the voice of the gods speaking, or of God, through this Sibyl, as she was called, They would have to wait 3 days, during which time they were interviewed by the pagan priests, who were pretty good at what they were doing. The next third morning, she would be chewing on narcotic leaves. They didn't know what this was. And as she would walk up the sacred way, she would start to get kind of intoxicated. They brought her to a place which had a brazier, a fire under it, in which narcotic leaves were burning, over top of which was a stone egg that kept the fire away from the Sibyl, but she got the smoke. And then on top was a little perch where she went. And she would start to become hysterical or drugged. She'd start babbling on. And supposedly the priests of Delphi would interpret what she was saying. Now, that's not important to us. It's a fraud. It's interesting that the priests were pretty good at their job because they were able at times to predict things, and at one time they saved the Greek city-states. Xerxes, the Persian emperor, invaded Greece, was coming down the peninsula. Nobody quite knew what to do. They sent to Delphi. The word came back, you'll never win if you fight on land, fight them in the sea. And the Greeks fought in the narrow straits, and they won, and Xerxes went home, and Delphi was made. The interesting thing when you go there is the amount of effort it took. Gigantic columns, 20 feet long, a single piece of marble, beautifully fluted in the Doric style. Huge ashlars, or foundation stones, of solid marble. Buildings, amphitheaters, marble, marble, marble. And the nearest marble quarry is 165 miles away. These huge objects were hauled, rolled on wooden rollers 165 miles uphill the last several miles. Can you imagine the amount of agriculture it took to grow food for the people and the beasts of burden? The amount of supplies, clothing, other supplies that were necessary, housing, got cold in the winter. The immense number of people involved in this project, the immense amount of expense in relationship to the gross national product of this society. For one thing, to hear the voice of God. I'll come back to that in a minute. They didn't hear the voice of God, but they were trying. That's the important thing. They took it seriously. I take you over to Japan and China. Whenever I go to a non-Christian country, I go to the temples to pray that the light of the gospel will come to that country. I pray to Christ, who is everywhere, the Son of God. And I don't pray, obviously, because I'd confuse the people. But I also look around and see what's going on, and it's pretty much the same crowd that we see in church. Pretty much the same kind of people. People are devout and praying. And I remember going in Japan to Kyoto, the shrines, the ancient Buddhist shrine. And all over those shrines, where people are praying devoutly and quietly, are cases containing little statues that look like a baby Buddha. These are votive offerings of parents who have aborted a child. These things are expensive, and they are brought to the temple as a matter of penance for killing their child. The mother is expected to go into seclusion, to pray for a long time. I saw a very somber-looking statue of the Buddha, mahogany, about 400 years old. And at the feet of this statue was a Raggedy Ann doll, brand new, in a plastic case. I have a picture of it. I said to the missionary father who was with me, "What's this?" "It's there so that the Buddha will give the doll to this child who was killed in the next life." They're trying. And although abortion is just as wrong in Japan as it is here, at least they're ashamed of it and think that they should do penance. They're doing better than we are, I'll tell you that. Wherever you go, you will see people praying with reverence. And this is important. There is reverence in the temples. In India, Southeast Asia, And at times I have attended, or at least have been on the edges of a Native America, a Native African attempt at prayer. A lot of work. I don't understand it. It's animistic. But the people are working at it. They are acknowledging with reverence, times with adoration, with respect, with concern, with a lot of work. They're trying to find God from what they know of the world, and they show adoration and praise. Now, you will say to me, it's the wrong God. Perhaps. Perhaps this is only a symbol and they're reaching up to the true God through it. I don't know. Perhaps it's the wrong prayer. Yes, it is the wrong prayer. But it's done in the right way. It's done with reverence. Did you ever go to the right prayer, to the right God, in the wrong way? Have you ever attended a Catholic or a Protestant or an Orthodox service, all of those being Christian services, which were not done so reverently? I have. I have. And it makes me very sad. Because I have seen people without the revelation of sacred scripture attempting to find God with great adoration and sincerity and devotion. I can't say that I think Christianity in the United States looks particularly devout to me. I'm fortunate I work with the poor. And the poor, when they come to church, are always well-dressed. Poor people would never, ever go to church in sport clothes or athletic clothes. Or they've been out jogging and popped into mass or something. Never. You go to a poor church in the big city slums or in the poor section of the city on a Sunday morning. Everybody's very well dressed. It's a sign of respect and reverence. I once went to a temple in Tokyo called Asakusa. There were the huge red gates. A lot of work. And on the gates, two gigantic rope sandals hanging on the gates. Each sandal must have weighed 1,500 or 1,600 pounds, made of hemp. They were almost 15 feet long. And I said to the missionary with me, what's this? He says, it's the sandals of God to show you that he's in the temple. We went in, and I was amazed because the altar looked like altar set for benediction. Six candles, a large vessel like a monstrance in the center, and where we would put the Blessed Sacrament, there was a disc. I walked up closer, and the disc was a mirror. It was tilted back and facing an aperture in the temple roof so that everyone in front of it could see the sky. The sky is the most powerful natural image of the infinity of God. A little woman came in. She knelt down, an old lady. She clapped her hands. And she prayed. She clapped her hands to get the attention of God. And she prayed with fervor, with devotion, with reverence. She thought she was talking to somebody. She thought somebody was listening. I would have to say that she was praying with devotion. The wrong prayer to the wrong God, perhaps. I don't know really who she's praying to. I shouldn't say that. But in the right way, that's much better than the right prayer to the right God in the wrong way. Reverence, adoration, devotion, they are universal human religious phenomena. And somebody would be a very half-baked Christian if they attempted to pray without those basic human sentiments of acknowledgement, as St. Paul says, of God's almighty power and his divinity. When Christians pray without reverence and devotion, it's like a cake with no cake but just icing. I'm not impressed. Somebody said many years ago, before you're a good Catholic, you have to be a good Christian. And before you're a good Christian, you have to be a good human being. It's also important to realize that these natural religious sentiments do lead people toward God, but they can also lead people away from God if they are supposed to be Jews or Christians. Jews or Christians, and also we share the Torah with the Islamic people. We are beyond the revelation of nature. A Christian, a Jew, a Muslim who goes into the New Age is going backwards. A Christian who prays to the God of the East and West Wind is going backwards. I think it's a very dangerous phenomenon. And where I'm inclined to see the serious attempts of other world religions with respect, because they're trying to fulfill the commandment to love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul. A Christian who goes back, and for that matter a Jew or a Muslim, is going in the wrong direction. It's very dangerous indeed. A rabbi once said to me, "We Jews have suffered a good deal at the hands of Christians, but we never suffered anything like we suffered at the hands of ex-Christian pagans. Would you like a list? Lenin, Stalin, Hitler, Goebbels, Goering, Mengele. These were people who went backwards. Hitler and the Nazis propagated a kind of crazy return to the Germanic natural religion. They were the original New Ages of the 20th century. Maybe New Age people are not informed about Christianity, even if they were baptized in it. In that way, their New Age attempts are a seeking. But for a Christian to go backwards, I think, is a violation of the first commandment. We need to have reverence, adoration, and an acknowledgement of God in his divinity and his almighty power. We need to speak to him, and it is that speaking and belief that the power that made us knows us and hears us. It is that which is really the foundation of the spiritual unity of the human race. That's when we do indeed come together, when we cry out to the God who has made us, and we give glory to him as our creator, as the one from whom we come, and toward whom we move and are called. As St. Paul says, in him we live and move and have our being.